From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Games. It's postseason time for the NBA and the NHL, and the NFL draft qualifies as sort of a second season too, right? Ahead on Only a Game, we'll have updates of all three, breaking news regarding the Florida drug bust that might involve the NHL and Major League Baseball, and a conversation with Matthew Side, author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success. Also, the Japanese way of the sword makes it to the shores of the U.S.
So I once played an elderly gentleman who needed help standing. It was the understanding more so than the physical power that allowed him to beat me. And this is why I think kendo is so popular in Japan, because you can be 80, 90 years old, and you could be having your way with an uber athlete who is 20 years old.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In NBA playoff action last night, the San Antonio Spurs spurred the Dallas Mavericks 94-90. Utah beat Denver 105-93, and the Boston Celtics slipped by Miami 100-98. The Atlanta Hawks hold a 2-0 advantage in their series against the Milwaukee Bucks. Game 3 is tonight in Milwaukee. Joining me now to discuss the surging Hawks and their playoff chances is Atlanta Journal-Constitution columnist Jeff Schultz. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Anytime.
Hawks forward Josh Smith had 21 points, 14 rebounds, and 9 assists in Game 2 against Milwaukee. A shame he didn't get that 10th assist. Anyway, afterward, Hawks owner Michael Guerin declared that Smith is the closest thing in the NBA to LeBron James. Is that hyperbole, or was that a serious assessment?
It's a little bit of both. Obviously, Josh Smith is not as good as LeBron James. He's not in that top two or three elite. They are very similar in that they're two of the only players, possibly the only two players, who can do everything on the court. I mean, Josh Smith just was voted the number two defensive player of the year, right behind Dwight Howard, his close friend. He can score inside. People would prefer he not shoot outside, but occasionally he can hit the jumper. He's a defensive force. He can pass. He can rebound. We saw all those things the other night. So I think that's really kind of where Michael Guerin was going with that. But, yeah, he like a lot of owners and sports executives in general, are sort of prone to hyperbole when it comes to touting their own athletes.
Swingman Joe Johnson may or may not be the team's biggest star right now, but he's certainly the most highly paid of the Hawks. He's in the fifth and final year of a $70 million deal. There are those who think that the team's playoff success will be largely determined by his play. You agree?
I do. Joe very much wants to be considered in that elite status that we were referring to earlier. LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Dwayne Wade, he wants to be considered in that. But he knows, like everybody else knows, that you have to come up with big plays at the biggest moments. Reggie Jackson, the former baseball player, wasn't known for what he did during the season. He was known as Mr. October because of what he did in the World Series. And for Joe Johnson to be considered among those elite players, and certainly to get the max money that he's going to be looking for after this season, he has to come through in the postseason. Now, he scored 27 points the other day, which led the team. He doesn't have to lead the team in scoring every game. He has to be the go-to guy, and everybody on the court has to know that he is the go-to guy. Then he will be considered one of those players.
Two players do not a team make, even two players like Josh Smith and Joe Johnson. Who else should we be paying attention to on the Atlanta squad as they move along in the playoffs?
Well, I got to tell you who had a great game in Game 2 was Al Horford. Al, as you know, won a couple of championships at the University of Florida. That's one thing the Hawks have going for them. They don't have a true center, but they are deeper than they've been in past years, and they can spread it around quite a bit. Mike Bibby can get hot at guard, and Marvin Williams occasionally could score. So they have nice balance in their lineup.
Assuming the Hawks continue to do as well as they've been doing against the undermanned Bucks, they're likely to see Orlando in the second round. How do they match up against them?
Well, this gets back to Al Horford and the man in the middle. Dwight Howard, an Atlanta product, he played high school ball here. In fact, here's a little anecdote for you. He goes back with Josh Smith. Their friendship goes back to preschool days.
When they were both only about 5'11".
Yeah, exactly. I asked Josh the other day, were you guys like throwing crayons at each other and like swatting them out of the air, you know? Just And his response was, no, our priorities back then were just trying to get potty trained. That's really where our focus was. Dwight Howard tips Orlando over the top in that matchup. Really, the Hawks match up with them, I think, everywhere else. But they don't have an answer for Dwight Howard. The Hawks do play very well at home in like the second round against Orlando, if that's who they should play. You know, then you're only talking about having to win one road game. And I think that's really why they believe they have a shot to really do some damage.
Let's assume that they not only do some damage against Orlando, but get all the way through. What would it be like in Atlanta if the Hawks played in the finals?
Oh, my God. Well, I've lived here for 20 years, and I can tell you that there's been only one pro championship in the time I've lived here. And actually, there's been only one pro championship, period. And that, of course, was the Braves in 1995, I believe. And the city pretty much was turned upside down. We're not spoiled like some people in Boston. You know what? The answer to your question is Atlanta is always one of the top-rated cities in terms of TV ratings in the NBA postseason. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of pro basketball fans here. You may not always know it by the number of people in the building. If they even just got past Orlando in the second round, I think people would be turned upside down.
Jeff Schultz is a columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jeff, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Sure, anytime.
During Thursday night's round one of the 2010 NFL draft, the Denver Broncos selected Florida's Tim Tebow at number 25. Most pundits had predicted that the 2007 Heisman Trophy winner would go in the second round or lower, which probably explains why he didn't. Pro draft prognosticators who thought quarterback Jimmy Clausen would go in the first round and that fellow quarterback Colt McCoy would go earlier than the third round got those picks wrong. Said prognosticators will guess today again and again and again and again during rounds 4 through 7. NFL teams make their selections based on several terabytes of physical data, but they also take into account what they think is or isn't going on inside players' heads. As Steve Goldstein of member station KJZZ reports, that's where the Wunderlich test comes in.
If last year's numbers are any indication, 2010's top pick, Oklahoma quarterback Sam Bradford, is going to be an extremely wealthy man. The 2009 number one choice, Detroit Lions quarterback Matthew Stafford, received a 6-year contract, which will pay him nearly $42 million in guaranteed money. Sure, the Lions were wowed by Stafford's throwing arm and competitiveness, but it didn't hurt that he scored a 38 on the Wunderlich test, the 12-minute, 50-question exam every draftee takes at the NFL Scouting Combine. Some sample questions include, the ninth month of the year is, and when rope is selling at 10 cents a foot, how many feet can you buy for 60 cents? In 1936, industrial psychologist E.F. Wunderlich, his real name, developed the namesake test to help employers decide how prepared the test taker was to do a potential job and whether he should be hired. Hall of Fame coach Paul Brown of the Cleveland Browns was the pioneer in leading the NFL to use the Wunderlich test.
We really stole the page from Paul Brown's notebook, so to speak.
According to Gil Brandt, Brown took the unconventional step of giving the test to players after they were drafted. Brandt was player personnel director for the Dallas Cowboys from 1960 to 1989. He says the Cowboys first gave the Wunderlich in 1960.
We felt it was important to give tests before we drafted the players. It's very easy to tell you who the top 3 or 4 people are in the draft, and it's very easy for you to tell you who the bad ones are. With the Cowboys, we used it as a tiebreaker.
Brandt says the Cowboys' theory was that to play certain positions like quarterback, a prospect had to get a high score, at least a 25, on the Wunderlich.
The quarterback position is a very, very hard position to play, and if you don't have a good Wunderlich test score, it's pretty hard for you to waste or take a player early in draft that you know is going to have a hard time mastering the system.
There are notable exceptions in the NFL's current crop of starting quarterbacks, though. Current Washington Redskins signal caller Donovan McNabb only scored a 14 before he was drafted by Philadelphia in 1999. Vince Young, who led the University of Texas to the 2006 BCS championship, got a 15, and future Hall of Famer Brett Favre scored a 22. Matt Hasselbeck of the Seattle Seahawks got a 29. He told the NFL Network that the Wonderlic offers a worthwhile measurement.
You can learn if a guy can problem solve, and playing in the NFL, there's a lot of problem solving. You know, your coaches prepare you all week for, you know, maybe five looks, and you get up there, there's a sixth look you've never seen before. You got to make some quick decisions, and the Wonderlic is all about quick decisions.
Kathy Colby should know all about the test. She is E.F. Wonderlic's daughter.
If you're picking a quarterback, I'm not sure how smart they are, as it's important as how fast do they run, and do they have the instincts to switch gears when the play breaks down. You're not going to tell that from the Wonderlic.
Colby has followed her father's lead in the field of brain testing, though she has focused on behavior rather than intelligence. Colby thinks the NFL might be better off trying to measure instincts rather than IQ.
My father created something that has lasted 70 years. It's good. It's a very powerful tool. But you don't use it to tell how someone's going to play a game. You use it to see whether they're going to be able to read the manual.
Former Cleveland Browns scout Russ Landy is NFL draft guru for the Sporting News. He says when the Wonderlic is used correctly, it's just part of a comprehensive toolkit.
If someone does poorly on it that we really think is a pretty intelligent player and a good player, it's a red flag that we got to go figure out why. Does he have a reading problem, a learning disability? The key is identifying what you get. You never want to draft a guy thinking you have one thing and then he comes to you and you're like, all of a sudden, wow, we have some real learning issues. We just took this guy expecting him to be able to get into the starting lineup by mid-season, and you get him in there and it's like, all right, he may be a good one, but it's going to be 2 years from now.
Wonderlic's daughter, Kathy Colby, says her dad created his test for the military and private industry. She recalls conversations with him that showed he wasn't sure it was a good fit for pro football.
But Dad, I wouldn't pick someone to play on my team based on the Wonderlic. And he'd say, well, of course not. That wouldn't be the primary thing or the only thing. He said it wouldn't hurt. Well, okay, Dad, it wouldn't hurt, but it's how they play the game. And he'd say, yeah, but we don't know how to measure what you're talking about. I kept after Dad about there's something else, and I don't think it's fair to just decide who you're going to pick on a team because how smart they are, because I never thought intelligence was all it was cracked up to be.
The NFL has been using the Wonderlic for 5 decades, so it shouldn't be a surprise when commentators talk about it today as ESPN and the NFL Network finish up their coverage of the 2010 NFL Draft. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
NHL players and fans in Buffalo and Montreal woke up encouraged this morning. In playoff action last night, the Sabres beat the Bruins 4-1 and the Canadiens beat Washington 2-1. Elsewhere, Vancouver dispatched L.A. 7-2 and Detroit ran over Phoenix 4-1. Stay tuned, because just a bit later, we'll talk to the Sports Illustrated reporter who broke the story of a 2009 Florida drug bust that may have serious implications for the Washington Capitals and for the NHL. It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
The cloud of volcanic ash that grounded airplanes throughout Northern Europe and Great Britain delighted almost nobody, except for the people who got free tickets to see a Bundesliga match last Friday night for free. The management of the Cologne team apparently felt so badly for folks inconvenienced when the Cologne-Bonn airport was shut down that they offered free tickets to the match to anyone who brought their useless airline tickets to the stadium. The team promised to provide the free tickets, quote, as long as stocks last, an offer that no doubt had thousands flying to the Cologne grounds. Well, maybe not flying.
Let's fly away. Pack a small bag.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, what do Federer, Beckham, and Mozart have in common? More than 10,000 hours of perfect practice. But first, it's been said by wags other than myself that the National Hockey League has never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. One recent example of this phenomenon is the league's inability to capitalize on February's stellar Olympic hockey tournament due to the publicity generated by a subsequent blindside hit scandal that forced the NHL to make a rare mid-season rules change. Perhaps another example of a missed opportunity for the NHL is the news of a May 2009 drug bust in Florida that, according to state officials, implicates members of the NHL's Washington Capitals and has been met with league ambivalence. Sports Illustrated's David Epstein broke the story this week, and he joins me now on the line. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the May 2009 drug bust and why Florida officials believe the Washington Capitals players may be involved.
Back then in May 2009, it was actually Philadelphia Customs intercepted a package coming from Slovakia that contained steroids and was on its way to a man by the name of Richard Thomas in Central Florida. Customs tipped off local law enforcement there, the Polk County Sheriff's Office, and when they went to pay Mr. Thomas a visit, they found more than $200,000 worth of illegal drugs and steroids in his home. So they took him in, and as they were about to announce the arrest in their press conference, one of the detectives asked him whether he had dealt steroids to professional athletes, and he said he had. He said, "You name the sport, and I've dealt to them." And he named the Washington Capitals and Nationals specifically, but not any players. It was kind of odd at the time, him being in Florida and naming just Washington, D.C. area teams. But then last month, a Washington, D.C. area chiropractor who has worked with some Capitals players was arrested as one of his clients.
What was the National Hockey League's response when informed of that drug bust and specifically informed that one of their teams had been named?
They pretty much did what Major League Baseball did as well, which was they promised to start an internal investigation and to cooperate with law enforcement.
Did they, in fact, put into practice this investigation they'd promised?
Well, it kind of depends who you ask. So based on my reporting, I published an account of their communications from law enforcement in Florida saying that in their private investigations with the NHL's head of security and with an official from the Washington Capitals, they told them that they had not conducted an internal investigation contrary to their public statements. Since my story came out, Gary Bettman, the commissioner of the league, said that there was a misunderstanding that they cooperated with the DEA. He said they were either in direct or indirect contact with the DEA, and I'm kind of at a loss to understand what exactly that means. And another Canadian reporter reported that sources told him that the NHL had started an investigation with Major League Baseball, who had an individual who represented all the leagues together, and that was supposed to be their investigation. So it's kind of unclear now, but certainly the Florida law enforcement authorities who are actually investigating the case are not happy with the NHL's level of cooperation or vigilance.
Well, not only not happy with their level of cooperation, but denying that the NHL really conducted any sort of investigation at all.
The narcotics supervisor for the Polk County Sheriff's Office asked the NHL head of security, and in an email that I looked at, he says that the NHL head of security said that they had not conducted an investigation. He bolded and underlined no before investigation, so it wasn't hard to interpret. I made a records request and then followed up by talking to law enforcement in Florida, and I was kind of astounded by their level of frustration with the NHL's cooperation.
Baseball's response, Major League Baseball's response differed from that, I gather.
Major League Baseball has, you know, having learned the hard way, has their own investigations unit. And they are, in my experience, you know, they don't really talk publicly about their investigations, but in my experience and what sources have told me, they are now very quick to contact and work with local law enforcement because that's really the only good way to conduct a thorough investigation. And they did that in this case, and the sheriff's office was quite happy with their cooperation.
Thomas is quoted as saying, "You name the sport, and I've sold steroids to athletes who play it." Is there a chance this matter will go beyond pro baseball and hockey?
Yeah, it's hard to say. The authorities know that he was sending steroids to other states. We don't know if he's talking about college athletes or other pro athletes or what exactly he's talking about. And after his kind of initial talkative period, he clammed up pretty quick. So it's hard to say.
Where do you think this story will go from here?
Well, Richard Thomas has a hearing in early June, so we'll see what happens with him, if there's any negotiating going on for his cooperation. Dr. Douglas Nagel, the chiropractor who worked with Capitals players, has maintained that the steroids he bought were for personal use, but law enforcement says that the quantities were too large to be for personal use, But I assume they will lean on him to say, tell us everyone that you sold steroids to, and you'll face a less harsh penalty. So I assume we'll see that coming up. And in Florida, they're still going through records they seized from Richard Thomas's house, so they still have quite a bit of work to do.
David Epstein is a staff reporter for Sports Illustrated. His story can be found in the April 26th issue of that magazine. David, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
To view our numerous photo galleries or listen to a show or story you may have missed, please visit onlyagame.org. Natural athletes can take up tennis as beginners in the morning and challenge the club champion by late afternoon. They can switch effortlessly to golf and fill in during an intramural soccer game without missing a step, even if they haven't previously played. Or not. In Bounce, subtitled Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and the Science of Success, Matthew Side argues that our understanding of the talent of the so-called natural athlete has always been imperfect, if not utterly wrong. Matthew Side joins me now from the BBC in London. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Good to be here.
Let's start with that concept of talent. Whether we're talking about Michael Jordan or Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, you argue that talent is overrated. How so?
Well, what is clear to me, and this is based on many years of experience as a table tennis player and since studying the science of success, is that there is no such thing as a shortcut. Every single person you see performing at an excellent world-class level in anything from basketball to tennis to music to business, they have spent a lot of time, astronomical amount of time, practicing. We all start out pretty ordinary. I was a two-time Olympic table tennis player, but I wasn't very good when I picked up a bat. But you become extraordinary through the transformational process of practice. You build new neural connections. The anatomy of the brain changes over time. Mm-hmm. And the inference, we often look at a fantastic performer and we think, I couldn't do that. Where is the evidence that you couldn't do it? The only way you can find out is by clocking up those hours. And all of the people who have clocked up those hours reach world-class level.
If it's thousands of hours of practice that led Roger Federer to become a champion tennis player and Bobby Fischer to become a superb chess player, to what extent does it follow that anybody who practices a sport or studies musical composition for 10,000 hours and more can reach the highest level of achievement in that discipline?
It's a terrific question. And the answer to it is based on very detailed science, mostly compiled by Anders Ericsson at Florida State University, who's done some wonderful cognitive psychology over many years. But he has dug down into the narrative histories of all those who have reached world-class level. So first of all, they have clocked up the 10,000 hours. But he's also looked at the counterfactual, those people who have clocked up 10,000 hours and failed to perform. But the thing is, there aren't any of those.
Well, or maybe they're just not talking. They're ashamed.
I guess it is conceivable that there is a level of hidden evidence out there. But those who have gone to look for it haven't found it. I would just make one proviso. Of course, not everybody who's played the same amount of basketball as Jordan or the same amount of the piano as Mozart reached the same level as they do. All of us who are healthy can make it to the top, but whether you get to the pinnacle probably pivots on something else, but it isn't clear quite what that is. It may well be the psychology of performance. It may well be the way they practice that has conferred an advantage. But what does seem clear is most of us have the potential to become excellent.
One of the variables that came into play for you, and you were a champion table tennis player, a two-time Olympian, and one of the variables that came into play was where you happened to be born, where you grew up. How did that play into it?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a very anonymous suburban town and on a very anonymous suburban street. And looking around me at the top world-class table tennis players in the 1980s, almost all of them came from the very same street. There wasn't a genetic mutation that affected only that street and none of the surrounding areas, but what we did have was a brilliant coach, and we had access to the only 24-hour club. So we transformed ourselves over time, and we see this hotbed phenomenon in other areas. So, for example, Spartak Moscow, the tennis club, produced more top 20 women players than the whole of the United States, and that club is quite an impoverished club in the Russian capital. And these hotbeds don't develop because of a specific genotype that exists in those locations. It's because these people have had very unusual opportunities to become excellent.
Your own specific case notwithstanding, your book, Bounce, is not lacking in generalizations. You write about life as having two paths at one point, and I'm paraphrasing, one leads to mediocrity, the other to excellence. Tell me about what determines which path various people choose.
Well, if you agree with the thesis that all of us have the ability to become excellent, the question is, why is it that some people persist? And I think there's two reasons. One, you have to care about the destination. Some people really care about becoming fantastic at basketball or becoming world class at the piano. And if you really care, of course, you're more likely to try and get towards the destination. But the problem, of course, is en route to the destination, every now and again, you're going to fail. You're going to mess up. If you believe that you have the ability to adapt and to grow, you're not going to interpret failure as a reason to quit. If, on the other hand, you believe that achieving excellence hinges on your natural talent, every time you mess up, you're going to think, well, I must lack the talent. It is a generalization, but Carol Dweck, the professor of psychology at Stanford University, has classified different people as having a growth mindset and the others have a fixed mindset, and there is robust statistical evidence that the way these two mindsets respond to failure is fundamentally different.
As you acknowledge in Bounce, even some of the most thoroughly prepared athletes who've practiced well over 10,000 hours sometimes choke. You specify Greg Norman at the Masters in 1996 when he blew what looked like a sure victory over several very poorly played holes, and Bill Buckner, who missed a single ground ball during the 1986 World Series with terrible consequences. But can you really legitimately compare those two very different circumstances, one ground ball with, I don't know, half an hour's worth of poor golf shots?
Yeah, it's actually difficult to make an inference that they're both because of the same underlying psychological phenomenon. I think we can say with a certain degree of certainty that what happened to Greg Norman was what we call choking, where a world-class performer was suddenly unable to perform the skill he had spent a lifetime perfecting. And the neuroscience behind choking is now very well established. It is a curious and rather unusual phenomenon, but one now, I think, that is fully explainable.
Well, please explain.
Well, I think probably the best way to understand this weird phenomenon is when you begin in any task, so say, for example, driving a car, you exert conscious control in order to build up the neural framework supporting the skill. So, for example, you know, you're looking in the mirror, you're pressing on the gas, you're turning the steering wheel, and you're consciously monitoring what you are doing, so much so that it's actually difficult to perform all those various tasks simultaneously. But over time, you can delegate those motor skills to, as it were, implicit memory. You can do it automatically, subconsciously. The problem is when an expert performer who is able to execute something like a 5-iron to the green at a subconscious level becomes so anxious, he tries to consciously control it. He almost becomes a beginner again. That's why the expert performer slows down. You remember Novotna against Steffi Graf in the Wimbledon final. She was serving the ball halfway up the net. She couldn't get into position. She was trying to consciously organize these very complex tasks. And because of that, it became stilted and sluggish. And that's when you have this catastrophic decline in performance. And so the best way is just to do it. I mean, the Nike commercial actually pithily summarizes it.
You just got to, for that reason.
You know what I mean? You just got to go. You just got to go and do it.
I'm speaking with Matthew Side, the author of Bounce, and you're listening to Only a Game. How do you relate your theories about how athletes achieve success to such stereotypes as Kenyans are naturally great marathoners and white men can't jump?
Yeah, it's a very interesting one, and actually a kind of a politically explosive issue. But often we will see a group of people doing well at something, Kenyans running terrifically well at 5,000 meters above, and we'll say, blacks must be better distance runners. It turns out it's not Kenyans who are good at distance running. It is a very small geographical population in the Western Rift Valley in and around a town called Eldoret. And it is just this very small subsection, with most of Africa actually underrepresented. And a Scottish academic, Yanis Pitsiladis, has actually taken cheek swabs from the top Kenyan and other distance runners to examine the DNA under a microscope. And he has found that there is no genetic mutation that explains the success of the Kenyan runners. Instead, he has found that what they tend to have in common is living a very long way from school, with school at altitude. And so over time, running, I mean, sometimes they're running upwards of 20 kilometers a day. They've built an aerobic capacity. So again, it comes back to the culture and the environment and not the genotype.
Matthew, you don't limit your theory that one gains expertise through a great deal of practice to athletes and artists, where perhaps their achievements are more measurable. You talk about business people and physicians as well, and how they might be better trained according to that theory of the science of success. Tell me a little more about that.
Well, I guess one thing, some of us will be in a job for 10, 15, 20 years without any noticeable improvement. My mother was a secretary, and she typed at 70 words a minute after some training, and she plateaued at that level for the rest of her life. And the reason is because she was pretty satisfied with where she had got to, and she didn't challenge herself to build up additional speed. But what we do know is when typists have been put through extra training, so they train in the way that sportsmen and women train, extending their existing limitations, seeking out advantage. They get up to 80, 90, 100, 140 words a minute, which is an astronomical improvement. And what I argue is that if you continue to challenge yourself, the improvements over time can be very dramatic.
Matthew Side, a BBC commentator and columnist for The Times of London, is the author of Bounce, Mozart, Federer, Picasso, Beckham, and The Science of Success, published by Harper. The author joined me from the BBC in London. Matthew, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
Water aerobics. Good for you, right? Well, yes, unless there's a crocodile in the water. That was the case on Tuesday at the Howard Springs Holiday Park in Darwin, Australia, when a crocodile that had been residing in a nearby swamp slipped into the pool just before the aerobics class was to begin. The local ladies of Howard Springs, who had signed up for the class, were undeterred by the unregistered guest. They were all waiting there for the ranger to collect it, said the park manager, Jeff Thompson, and once he got it out of the water, they started their aerobics. Afterward, they ate the crocodile and made him into shoes and belts. No, they didn't. I made that last part up. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the thwack of victory and the thwack-thwack of defeat. It's the sport of kendo, but first I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill. You know, I actually, as a fencer, I actually tried kendo once.
Uh-huh.
I used to have, like, two knuckles on this hand,
oh.
And now I only have one.
Oklahoma quarterback Sam Bradford was taken number one in the NFL draft by the St. Louis Rams. Two other Oklahoma guys went 3 and 4, defensive tackle Gerald McCoy and offensive tackle Trent Williams. Big night for Sooners fans.
How did that team not play for the national championship last year? I'll tell you why Sam Bradford got hurt, which I think probably should have given the St. Louis Rams a little bit more pause than they took. My favorite person in the draft, Ndamukong Suh, a.k.a. House of Spears, is off to Detroit.
It was also a big night for Florida quarterback and Heisman Trophy winner Tim Tebow. The Denver Broncos shocked almost everyone when they took the fantastic in college but allegedly unequipped for the NFL Tebow with the 25th pick in the draft. Tebow's NFL jersey is already on sale in the Broncos Pro Shop. You got your order in yet?
I don't, because I want to go buy, like, Brady Quinn and Kyle Orton jerseys before they have to go on, like, 50% off sale. Josh McDaniels, the coach in Denver, is a protege of Bill Belichick's, and he seems to have caught the I'm really smarter than everyone else virus from his mentor, and he's going to try to make do with this now.
Charlie, since we last spoke, the National Football League has issued a 6-game suspension to Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger. When it was time for the Steelers to make their first-round pick in Thursday's draft, the crowd at Radio City Music Hall started chanting, "She said no."
God.
I guess it's a good thing the NFL had a PR ploy at the ready.
Yeah, actually, it was quite nice of the crowd to stop chanting that when Zach Hatfield, who's 15 years old and a leukemia patient, was part of the Make-A-Wish program from the NFL, actually went up to the microphone to announce the Steelers' choice. But it's very sharp of the crowd there. Usually they're not quite sober enough to be that sharp at that point in the evening.
During the NBA's regular season, the Oklahoma City Thunder improved their record by 27 wins, which was good enough to earn their coach Scott Brooks Coach of the Year honors. Good choice?
Terrific choice. I really don't want to like this choice because I really hate the way the people who own the Oklahoma City Thunder blackjacked their way out of Seattle, which was a tremendous NBA market. But with Kevin Durant, who I think is the NBA's MVP this year, and Scott Brooks, this is a heck of a year.
The NCAA announced this week that CBS and Turner Broadcasting will pay $10.8 billion to air the men's basketball tournament for the next 14 years. The league also announced that the tournament would likely be expanding to only 68 teams next year instead of the proposed 80 or 96. You think they'll still be able to fit the bracket on one page?
This year, but the 68 teams is just a stepping stone to the eventual 96-team field, which they want. The outcry was so loud this year about going right to 96 teams that they figured they'd give us a chance to get used to the 68-team field for a couple of years and then jack it up again. I agree with Jim Calhoun, frankly. This is something you don't need to mess with.
$10.8 billion, that mean the players get a raise?
Are you kidding? It means some people get a raise, but not the players.
The New Jersey
Devils.
Unless,
of course, you want to build the table a little higher so there's more room to get more money under it.
The New Jersey Devils were knocked out of the NHL playoffs by the 7th seed Philadelphia Flyers on Thursday night. You surprised to see a number 2 seed in the East depart so early?
Not the New Jersey Devils. They've done it 3 years in a row now. And among other people, Martin Brodeur, their terrific goalie, is really, really upset about it at this point. This is a 4-1 series loss, though. This is not the way it was when they got beat in 7 games against Carolina last year. The Devils didn't show up for this playoff series, and I think they're probably going to have wholesale changes made.
The New York Yankees lost to the Oakland A's on Thursday night, but the real story of that game is what Alex Rodriguez did in the top of the 6th inning when he took a shortcut across the pitcher's mound. Do you agree with A's pitcher Dallas Braden that A-Rod's crime against baseball etiquette was very serious indeed?
I don't consider baseball etiquette very serious, though. I don't think there's any crime.
I'm shocked.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, Dallas Braden can go chew on a rock. I don't care if somebody runs across the pitcher's mound. I truly don't.
It's his pitcher's mound.
It's not his pitcher's mound. He didn't buy it. He didn't pay for it.
The same guys who own the New York Knicks and the New York Rangers, James and Charles Dolan, also own the newspaper Newsday. Is it a coincidence that the paper's editors have been told their sports section should display, quote, a softer tone?
Yes, it's a complete coincidence. If you go to the window and look out, you'll see the load of turnips I rode to work today. Of course, it's not a coincidence. And as far as I know, neither of the Dolans has any stake in National Public Radio. So can I tell them to chew on a rock, too? You know, we are victimized always by our sudden desire for civility in this business. The one part of the newspaper that is so unserious that it demands irreverence, and these people are pulling the plug.
The top attraction, or at least the best player, on the LPGA Tour announced her retirement this week, Charlie. Lorena Ochoa is only 28 years old, but she's decided she has more important things to do than play golf. This is not what the LPGA Tour needs, is it?
No, not really. I mean, she was the best player on the tour. Her profile was high, but not terrifically high, certainly not as high as Annika Sorenstam was when she retired a couple of years ago. This is, you know, retiring to start a family. As I recall, it's exactly what Nancy Lopez did a while back, too.
I assure you, the 29-year-old sumo wrestling champion has had his problems recently, Charlie. Tales of a drunken nightclub rampage have dogged him, and he's being sued for failing to show up at some scheduled appearances, and he's responding to these difficulties. How?
He's retiring and going to his unlikely new passion, flowers and gardening. And good for him. He says he wants to create forests in Mongolia, which is where he was born.
Mm-hmm.
And good for him, because I think Mongolia could use some forests. I'm just concerned about, we're used to, like, nightclub brawls in this country involving baseball players and even the occasional football player. I don't want to own the nightclub where the sumo guys get into a brawl, okay? I really don't, because I think by the next morning you've pretty much got a parking lot.
And finally, Charlie,
sports!
What do 114 people simultaneously skiing behind the same boat have in common with a fellow who built a house of 218,792 playing cards?
They are now in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Correct.
I'm just going to go out and get the USS Nimitz and screw this whole thing up is what I'm going to do.
And have the entire U.S. Navy water ski behind it.
Absolutely. They have a couple of thousand people back there.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
How do sumo wrestlers get by the nightclub's dress code?
The Way of the Sword, that's the literal translation of the Japanese word kendo. Kendo is also the name of the centuries-old martial art of Japanese fencing. Only a Game's Doug Trabue recently attended the largest intercollegiate kendo tournament in the United States, and he has this report.
There are about 120 competitors in the gym at Harvard University's Malkin Athletic Center, plus coaches, supporters, and tournament officials. But as the kendo matches are about to begin, there is silence, followed very quickly by this. Kendo is Japanese fencing, a martial art derived from the sword fighting of Japan's samurai warriors. The roots of the modern-day sport date back to the early 18th century when the bamboo swords, or shinai, were first introduced. Shori Yuhai is Harvard's invitational kendo tournament, held every year on a weekend in April. Today's team event and Sunday's individual competition have attracted male and female kendo practitioners from 22 colleges and universities. The gym floor has been divided into four 25-foot squares. The athletes are barefoot, and most are wearing navy blue gis, tops similar to those worn in karate, and wide flowing pants called hakamas. The kendo mask, or men, is an oval made up of thin metal bars. Kofi Kumi is the chairman of the Harvard Radcliffe Kendo Club Alumni Association. He explains the team tournament format.
So usually in matches between two schools, there are five people competing. They go one at a time in a specific order. At the Shoryuhai, they're trying to hit one of three spots, really. Right? Men being the head, Kote being the right wrist, Do being the side of the stomach. First person to get 2 points, and they have 2 minutes to kind of do so. Then they call the winner of the match. And then in later rounds, when we get to quarterfinals, it'll be 3 minutes per match.
All of the shimpan, or judges, male and female, are dressed in dark blazers, gray slacks, white shirts, and red ties. Teams tie red or white kerchiefs to the back of their gis. As the three shimpan circle a match, they each hold a white flag in one hand and a red in the other, and raise the appropriate color when a point is awarded. Daniel Von Beek, a senior at the University of California, Davis, has been practicing kendo since he was in high school.
My father is the pastor of an all-Japanese church in Sacramento, California, and one of our members was an old kendo sensei, and they just suggested that I try. And when you're the son of the pastor, you can't really say no to anybody, so that's how I got started.
Von Beek says it takes more than striking your opponent to earn a point.
Then there is a kiai, which is the yelling. So you have to actually yell the name of the point you're hitting. If I yell men, which is the head strike, and I hit the wrist, then they know I didn't really mean to hit the wrist. So if you hit the men and you yell men, they know, oh, you meant to do that. It's not an accident.
It's like calling your shots in pool.
Just like calling your shots in pool, except you have to do it on the spot simultaneously. The idea is that you can hit and it won't be a point, but it has to be considered a cut for it to be a point.
In addition to making having a clean hit, there's really a lot of sort of form and posture to it.
Exactly. If you think about the basis of kendo, which is, combat between samurai, they're all wearing this armor. So if you're going to cut through someone's armor and their arm, it has to be pretty perfect.
The clashes during matches can be both vigorous and violent. Practitioners frequently end up almost mask to mask with their shinai locked and often use their bamboo swords to shove their opponents away. Unlike Western fencing, kendo competitors keep both hands on their swords and swing them in a downward or sideways slicing motion. The shinai are made of four flexible bamboo slats, and athletes wear body armor to protect their chests, abdomens, and wrists. But Von Beek says kendo matches are still painful.
Most people believe that once you have the armor on, nothing hurts. It still hurts a lot. The armor is really there more to prevent injury than to prevent pain.
After the quarterfinals, teams from UCLA, Soka University of America, the University of Washington, and Stony Brook advance. While some tournaments have separate divisions for men and women, at Shoryu High, male and female athletes compete side by side. In fact, dressed in full gear, it's often difficult to differentiate between them. Ohio State's Trisha Kubrin says during matches, the men are noticeably more aggressive than the women.
Whenever I play a girl, it's kind of like you feel each other out first. You kind of like play a little bit, but with guys, they just boom, 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 and they're just like coming at you. You're like, I have not gotten a proper feeling of how this is going yet because you're just coming straight at me.
Kendo is also filled with rituals. Before a match, both competitors squat in the center of the square, raising their swords so the tips nearly touch. At the end, they kneel and pantomime sheathing their weapons on their hips before backing to the court's edges and bowing as they exit. Axel Wilhite is a member of New York University's Kendo Club. Wilhite began practicing kendo in high school in Los Angeles and says the rigidity of the rules and etiquette appeal to him.
I find it to be very meditative, you know. It's very deep in that respect, and you're learning everything all the time, just these little tiny aspects. And then you have this amazing sport where you get to fight other people, you know, with bamboo swords.
The All Japan Kendo Federation lists about 1.5 million registered Japanese kendo practitioners, and the International Kendo Federation has affiliate organizations in nearly 50 countries. The Harvard tournament was founded in 1997 and quickly gained international attention. The next year, then-Japanese Prime Minister Rutaro Hashimoto donated trophies and called the tournament Shoryuhai, or Rising Dragon, symbolizing the growing popularity of collegiate kendo in the U.S. The name stuck, and the trophies are still used today. This year, a number of elite black belts, or dons, traveled from Japan for the tournament, including Hironori Tahara. Tahara is a Hachidan, or 8th-degree black belt. Speaking through a translator, Tahara says he's pleased to see kendo's popularity growing.
In one word, he's delighted to see that something that was born in Japan, raised in Japan, and developed in Japan has now went overseas, just like judo, and now has a very international participation pool.
Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Psychology Kentaro Fujita is a fourth-degree black belt and is serving as a shimpan today. He says athletes often continue competing for much longer than they would in other sports because kendo is as much mental as it is physical.
So I once played an elderly gentleman, a kendo player, who needed help standing. So physically, he was much weaker than me. I was a college student. And yet, because his knowledge of what I was going to do with him was so much more than mine, I ended up flailing away, and I got angry, and I tried to launch myself at him, and I was basically on the floor because his understanding of my movements, it was the understanding more so than the physical power that allowed him to beat me. And this is why I think kendo is so popular in Japan, because you can be 80, 90 years old, and you could be having your way with an uber athlete who is 20 years old.
Eventually, Washington and the A team from UCLA advance to the finals. The other competitors and spectators gather around a single court. In the end, UCLA comes out on top, earning its fifth team title in 7 years. But the day doesn't end with the trophy presentation. After the ceremony, students pair off for rounds of open sparring, and many coaches and shimpan put on their own gear and join in. And the ancient tradition of kendo continues. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
To view Doug's kendo photos, please visit our website. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from BBC London. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or to learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages at Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from Bounce author Matthew Side, who admits that people from all walks of life can benefit from practicing something, anything, for over 10,000 hours.
And it's the same, actually, in the criminal underworld. You'll have people practicing at being better criminals and getting better and better at it. I hope very much that the theory I describe will be used by people in the right way.
So if you're a bad person, please don't read Bounce. Please. Bill Littlefield, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.